Monster Man, bonus episode, July 2023. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a bonus episode, going out to my Patreon backers at all levels as a way of saying thank you for your continued support. In these bonus episodes, I talk about what I've been up to, I talk about things that are on my mind, what I've been watching, reading, doing, and so on. So let's start with a quick overview of July. July has been a pretty busy month for me. July is the month that I do my summer teaching. This is a completely separate thing from my usual teaching and tutoring work, and it's pretty intensive. So I teach, so this year it's just for 2 weeks, 4 hours in the classroom every day. Actually, not quite every day, because there were some days that the students were like on trips or things like that. So it wasn't so bad, but it is one of those things where every July when there's summer teaching, I say to myself, oh great, that'll be my mornings. Then I'll finish at 1, I'll have lunch, and I'll be ready to work on other things by 2. And that'll just be like an afternoon that I can devote to painting or to working on the show or whatever, because I'm not that passionate about this, but it pays the bills, work done for the day. But the thing is, it's actually quite exhausting doing 4 hours in a classroom. So I don't really get as much done in the afternoons as I would like. Also during July, I had some travel. So I was in Eastbourne, which doesn't sound that exciting. So if you're from the UK, you know that Eastbourne is a town on the Sussex coast. It's sort of one of those faded former, I guess it still is a little bit like holiday destinations. During the 19th century, this whole class of like English seaside town sprung up. Right? They were places that were on the coast, but were within a short train ride of London. And as a result, they became popular destinations for the growing class of English people that could afford a little recreational travel. But what killed them was essentially cheap airlines. You know, now it's equally easy to go to Spain. Indeed, it probably took you longer to get from Cambridge to Eastbourne than it would to get from Cambridge to Spain. However, I wasn't there to take in the sun and the sand. I was there for a roller derby event with my wife, Allison, which was great. You know, we went and took the dog as well, and everyone had a great time, especially the dog. But I did get a chance to get some reading done, which was nice, because normally the roller derby event in Eastbourne, Eastbourne Extreme, is outdoors, but on the Saturday, they were rained out. So they had to relocate to the indoor venue, and the indoor venue is not very big, so there are no spectator seats. So I just had the day off, and so I went around and went shopping with the dog. Not that she bought anything, but just had a nice day, strolled along the beach, pepper splashed in the ocean a little bit, etc., etc. But I also got a chance to catch up on my reading, so I had a pretty good reading month. I started off my reading this month with Reach of the Roach God. This is a project that's part of 1,000 Thousand Islands. I backed it on Kickstarter a long time ago. Well, I don't know, like last year or whatever. It is written by ZXU, who, of course, has been a guest on this show, and illustrated by Mun Cao. And, of course, it wasn't very long after it came out that we discovered that ZXU and Mun Cao had kind of fallen out over, you know, who controlled what and who was in charge of what in the Thousand Thousand Islands project, which is a shame. But, you know, obviously, I don't know the ins and outs of the dispute. But I think it's always, you know, I think these things can happen in joint creative works. And I think it's, you know, it's always a shame if you're a fan of the thing. But I'm, you know, looking forward to future projects from ZDEC, you know, whose work I've always been a big fan of. I mean, I say always, you know, as long as I've known about it, which has, of course, not been always. Anyway, Reach of the Roach God, it's good. I don't know that I'm super likely to run it, but there are a couple of things in it that I really, really like. I say I'm not likely to run the one of the things that I like about Lauren's Song of the Bachelor, which remains my favorite ZXU thing, is that it's a very good length, and Reach of the Roach God might be a little bit more ambitious than I'm currently. It wouldn't fit into my existing fantasy game, and I'm probably not going to run a whole second one. Larger things are harder to fit in to existing games, about which more later. I read some comics this month. That was kind of cool. I read the Immortal Hulk Omnibus Volume 2. This is part of that run on Hulk. Well, the book's called The Immortal Hulk. That was written by Al Ewing and drawn by Joe Bennett. Shame about Joe Bennett turning out to have some, some views I cannot endorse. But the comic is very good. Hulk is a difficult character. You know, he's one of those characters who, for all that he's sort of, you know, iconic and beloved and so on, he's actually maybe not ever fully found success in comics. There are a couple of, you know, well-loved runs on the Hulk, but, you know, his own book was canceled very shortly after it started, you know, way back in the 60s. He's an interesting character. Everyone kind of relates to the core concept, but actual successful Hulk runs are few and far between. Anyway, I like this one. I mentioned that I was reading Hawksmoor, the novel by Peter Aykroyd. Is it Aykroyd or Aykroyd? Anyway, whatever, that guy. Obviously, this was a big deal in the 80s, and it's very interesting to see how things were influenced by it. I don't know exactly what the timeline is like on From Hell, but I mean, the parallels there seem very clear. I enjoyed it. Of kind of like horror-y, I don't know, you wouldn't call it horror, but there's definitely that kind of element to it. There's a sort of like, gothic's not the right word either, but there's, you know, there's some of that element. And actually, it maybe unsettled me more than most things I read that are attempting to unsettle me. And it wasn't anything to do with the kind of supernatural horror aspect of it, or implied supernatural horror aspect. But actually, well, I mean, you know, if you want to say that this is part of that horror aspect, then that's fine. But there's a scene in which you see a character's like progression of mental illness to the point where he becomes homeless. And I at least found it very convincing, this very gradual and then very rapid loss of connection to society. And I think that it's not uncommon for people to be kind of isolated in that way, where something could happen to them and there wouldn't really be anybody there who felt like it was their responsibility to help them out. So you wind up with these people who are sort of nobody else's problem. It made me think of cases I know about that have kind of progressed in a similar way. Kind of a fragility of life thing, I guess, right? There's never more than this much between you and winding up like that. Maybe not, you know, me personally. I'm not gonna like lose my mind and then leave my house one day and never return. If I succumb to my mental problems in that way, what'll happen is I will never leave my house, which is a whole other set of problems. I read some more comics. I read the first volume of the Ta-Nehisi Coates run on Black Panther, called A Nation Under Our Feet. Coates was one of those people who got brought on at Marvel largely because of his success writing in other fields, but I think this is a pretty good run. I haven't read any of his run on Captain America, but I've heard it well spoken of. I enjoyed this. I enjoyed the way that it engages with the thing that, like, Black Panther is supposed to be this almost kind of role model-like character. He's a rare instance of a Marvel character who the flaws in the Black Panther story come not from T'Challa's personal flaws. Well, sometimes they do. But typically, he's a more conventionally heroic character struggling with the flaws in the world around him. The obstacles to Black Panther are more often external. And, of course, this has something to do with his sort of position as, you know, really the foremost black superhero. If you wanted to argue that it's Power Man, I mean, that's, you know, that's whatever. But I think it's probably Black Panther, the more so in the wake of Chadwick Boseman's performance in the Marvel films. But consequently, I feel like there's a reluctance maybe to make this character quite as Marvel-y as some of the other Marvel characters. He's almost more like a DC character, you know? He's a bit more like Superman in that, you know, Superman, in the end, Superman's the right guy and he'll kind of always do the right thing. And then this actually sort of, I think, deviates from that a little bit because, you know, maybe there's a feeling that, like, you know, someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates has maybe the freedom to grapple with those concepts in a way that maybe not every writer would, but also because if you're going to have such a role model-y character, I guess it's a little weird that he's a king. Kings are not really things that, you know, one ought to be in favor of. Kings, in the main, are not great. So anyway, I thought it was good. It's one of those things where most comics that I read are things that I see in the library or I pick up secondhand. So if I see the next one at the same good price I paid for the first one, I'll probably read it, but I don't know that I would make it my business to hunt it down. And that's actually probably true of The Immortal Hulk as well, even though I really like them both. Gaming stuff, or a lot of gaming stuff. So I read, I mentioned Reach of the Roach God. I also read the Prosopedia, the Encyclopedia of Gods and Myths that just came out for RuneQuest. You know, I love Glorantha, so this was a very obvious purchase for me. It's always fascinating to me, like, there are bits of it that I kind of skip. You know, everyone who loves Glorantha, except for a small number of absolute diehards, really only loves one part of Glorantha, mainly Prax or Dragon Pass. And so there's all these bits in there about like, oh yeah, this is what's going on in Vithela or Teshnos or whatever. And I'm just all meaningless to me. But, you know, it's sort of, I think it'll be very useful. I'm definitely that kind of person who reads a lot of Glorantha stuff, but doesn't necessarily like, if I read something about something happening in Agant Feraltilian, like, it'd be handy to have an encyclopedia that would tell me where Agant Feraltilian was. It's actually not in the book, but it's not a deity, it's a city. It's like a ruined city. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Speaking of the work of the late Greg Stafford, I also read Prince Valiant, the storytelling game, which I picked up at the Bring and Buy at Dragon Meet all the way back in December of last year, and have only got around to finishing now. What do you want me to say? I thought it was good. It is interesting, though, because I do feel like Prince Valiant, the storytelling game, is sort of famous for, in many ways, being like, today I don't think any of its mechanics would be seen as particularly out of the ordinary in a sort of post-story games world, but in 1989 they were quite groundbreaking. And then also, it's Prince Valiant, and I don't think most people care very much about Prince Valiant, the, you know, a very old-fashioned comic strip when it sort of faded from the public eye in the 80s. I don't know when Prince Valiant was canceled, but certainly I stopped seeing it in my local newspaper when I was a kid. That just might mean that the San Jose Mercury News no longer carried it, or whichever San Francisco paper my parents got. I don't remember. Anyway, that was my reading for this month. Prince Valiant. Interesting, and kind of curious that it's Prince Valiant. Although I have to say that knowing that Greg Stafford was a, you know, longtime Prince Valiant fan, that sounds about right. So although I had a good reading month, it wasn't much of a film watching month. I watched a few things. I watched Mank, it's not a biography, but the picture about the writer of Citizen Kane, directed by David Fincher, which I thought was interesting. You know, the gimmick is that it's told through a series of flashbacks. So, you know, in a way, it's kind of like Citizen Kane. It's got good performances in it. You know, I enjoyed it. I don't know to what extent it represents an accurate portrayal of the election that, you know, is sort of like the main theme of its flashbacks. This idea that Hollywood moguls conspired to hobble a socialist Democratic candidate in the 1930, what, four, six, whatever it was, California gubernatorial election. I mean, I'm sure that's true, but I don't know how much of the exact details are right. But yeah, I thought it was good. I watched a documentary, Pez Outlaw, which is about this guy. It's good. It's very like, it's sort of fiasco-y, unknown armies-y, but it's also not. Like, it's actually, you can summarize exactly what happened in a couple of sentences, right? Here's what actually happened. What happened is that the company that makes Pez dispensers, you know, the little candy dispensers with the flip-up heads, they didn't care very much about the secondary market. So, American secondhand toy reseller gets the idea to go find Pez's in Eastern Europe, right? This is in the sort of aftermath of the end of the Cold War, so it's the early 1990s. He goes to Eastern Europe where these are manufactured, and he finds ones that you can't get in America, and he just like brings them back to the US in his luggage, and he sells them for a lot of money, and possibly he is actually like making deals with the people who run the factories to get Pez dispensers that he's not supposed to have access to. Eventually, Pez gets wise to this and finally decides that it's smart to engage with the collector's market, and in doing so, they basically drive him out of business. Like, that's kind of all that really happens, but it's fascinating. It's presented in a very humorous way. I enjoyed it. I watched They Cloned Tyrone, kind of a like retro blaxploitation sci-fi conspiracy comedy. It's kind of like an Edgar Wright movie if it was, you know, blaxploitation, starring Tiona Paris, John Boyega, and Jamie Foxx. And I thought it was good. I felt a little bit like it didn't stick the ending, right? The setup was better than the payoff, as is often the case in these kinds of things, because essentially the setup involves creating an unsolvable problem, and then the resolution involves solving it in a way that's always going to be a little unsatisfying. I watched a racing picture, Le Mans 66, known in the US as Ford versus Ferrari, which is a terrible name. Goodness me. Anyway, I don't really care about motorsport, but they did the driving scenes very well. They were very tense and exciting. And, you know, it's got good actors in it. Nice to see John Bernthal doing something a little bit different in a role as future infamous auto executive Lee Iacocca. It is interesting that every so often you get a reminder that Matt Damon is good at acting, because he kind of wore out his welcome for a while. A little bit like Russell Crowe in that respect. Like, for a while, I think the movie-going audience had just had its fill of Russell Crowe. But he's actually pretty good when he tries. Anyway, same with Matt Damon, who's good in this. See also Christian Bale. I watched How to Blow Up a Pipeline. It's a thriller about terrorists, but like people engaged in direct action. And I think what really stood out about it for me is that it like addressed some arguments against what they were doing, but it mostly portrayed them as good guys, right? It proceeded from the understanding that while one may quibble about their methods, the people who, you know, sabotage oil pipelines or whatever are good guys. You know, they're motivated by a desire to protect others. Some may disagree. Some reviews of the movie were really against what they understood as its political stance, but I thought it was good. You know, maybe I'm within the target market, but actually I just thought it was a well-made thriller. Like, I hate thrillers. I don't hate them, but they leave me cold. I don't know. I need a twist, or I need them to be exceptionally well-made. And I wouldn't say this was exceptionally well-made, but I thought it was good. I enjoyed it. And finally, I watched superhero sequel Venom: Let There Be Carnage, which I'm painting a lot of miniatures at the moment because in August, I'm going to BOIL, which is short for Bring Out Your Lead, and is the annual gathering of the Oldhammer community. And I am hosting a game there. And in order to do this, like, I've written a scenario, and I have certain figures that I need for my scenario, and I'm just kind of like trying to catch up on the painting. And so I like to have something on the computer monitor playing that I don't have to pay very much attention to while I am painting. And in this instance, it was Venom 2. Which, like, Venom 1 won great. And this one is, you know, here's the thing. Venom 2 would have been fine if it cost less money. Because the idea to kind of make it weirder and funnier, like to sort of emphasize the buddy cop element of the Eddie Brock and Venom characters, that makes sense, I suppose. Tom Hardy's performance is unhinged. Speaking of people who were all the rage and then were at their welcome, it's not terrible. It could be a good, dumb little action movie if it weren't for the fact that I presume it cost $100 and some million because it's got all the CGI in the universe and Sony wanted to make this into, like, the tentpole of the Venomverse or what have you. And it just can't bear that kind of weight, right? Like, Venom as a character can't bear that kind of weight. I don't think that Iron Man is a particularly interesting character, but there's something to say about Iron Man. And if you play Iron Man straight, you can get a pretty good movie out of it. I mean, I don't like what the Marvel movies have turned into, but, you know, in terms of being a story with a beginning, middle, and an end, and so forth, Iron Man, (2008) close parentheses, is pretty good. This thing is wild. It's simultaneously so, like, lightweight and so convinced that it's important. Or not that it's important, but it's just necessarily it's such a big deal because it all ties into how it relates to the different, I don't know. I think we are due, perhaps overdue, a reckoning when it comes to superhero franchises. I've been watching, well, I have now watched all of Secret Invasion, the new Marvel TV series, and it is bad. Like, it's just a big bunch of nothing. And I've always felt that superhero films have been speedrunning the development of superhero comics. Actually, you could say this about television as well, right? When they got to, like, Crisis on Infinite Earths and, like, putting things in to kind of justify their weird timeline things in the DC shows. You know, it's not that any of these things are necessarily bad, but they are challenging and they have to be handled in a particular way. And I really feel like Secret Invasion just sort of relies on a level of presumptive investment in the fate of Samuel Jackson as Nick Fury that is much higher than I actually possess. And also the subtext is kind of not great in that, as far as I can tell, it's about how you shouldn't accept refugees because they'll turn out to be terrorists. So that's a bit weird. Anyway, there were a lot of things in it that made me think, like, oh, this show is from 3 years ago, because, or maybe more than 3 years ago, but it felt really delayed, because first, there was a thing about how one of the signs that, you know, the world was on the brink of war was that Russia was about to invade Ukraine, which obviously hits a little weird in 2023. Second, there was some stuff in it that made me feel like it was meant to come before The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, because there's a really telling, I mean, spoilers, I guess, for Secret Invasion, if you care about this kind of thing. There's a scene in Falcon and the Winter Soldier where Rhodey, you know, Don Cheadle's character, and Sam Wilson, Anthony Mackie's character, talk about like what it means to be a superhero, what it means to be like a patriotic hero and be a black man in America, right? Which feels like the kind of conversation a little more sensitive than the imposter Rhodey from this show would be capable of. But I think we're meant to believe that that's the imposter. I don't, you know, who cares? The third thing is that they tried to make their like super powerful new character be a big deal. And one of the ways in which it's a big deal is they cast Emilia Clarke to play the role. And I do think that there was a period, you know, I mean, less than 10 years ago when that would have been a really smart move. You know what I mean? Like a good deal less than 10 years ago. When did Game of Thrones end? I don't even remember. But like prior to the last two seasons of Game of Thrones, I think people were pretty into Emilia Clarke. And through no fault of her own, the last seasons of that show just kind of, my understanding is that in the various sort of films she's been in, she's been fine. But I definitely think that the movie stars that they tried to make out of Game of Thrones, you know, her and Kit Harington and Richard Madden, I would say that none of those have really quite landed, you know? I do think that there's maybe a shortage of the kind of films in which she would excel. But anyway, yeah, so there was something slightly dated in feel about Secret Invasion, and also it was boring and it went nowhere. Nice to see Adrian Pasdar working, though. I'm sure he's been in a bunch of things that I just haven't seen, but it's always nice when Adrian Pasdar turns up. Gaming-wise, I mentioned that, boy, did I, when was my LARP event? Was that the beginning of the month? I think it was. So I went, did some LARPing. That was fun. The travel was long. That's a hassle, but you know, it was fine. Yeah, I think it was like the second week of July. Nice to see all my friends that I only see on those occasions. Although, of course, because the travel is so long, I have to leave pretty shortly after game ends and arrive pretty shortly before it starts. So I actually don't get that much time to talk to them, which is kind of a bummer. The great big UK LARP system is not that far from where I live, and I probably have enough people I could hitch a ride with that part of it wouldn't be a hassle. But everything else about that game makes it feel like it is a second job. So I'm probably not going to start playing it. I barely have time to play all the games I'm in. My Cthulhu game didn't run this month. That is the game that I play in. But instead, some of the other players in that game got together to playtest a miniatures scenario that one of the members, the guy who runs the game, had written. So that was fun. I canceled my Rogue Trader game in preparation for Bring Out Your Lead. And I am plugging along in my RuneQuest game and the D&D game I play in. And I ran some sessions of my D&D game, or at least one. A lot of rescheduling happening in summer. I guess people are traveling a lot, you know? I myself am going to be away for much of next month. Anyway, the reason I wanted to mention the D&D game I run is that I ran the scenario Crypts of Indormancy by Ezra Clavery. It's published by Malsonian Arts Council, and it's written for something not unlike BX. And I ran it at 5e, basically just kind of conceptually taking the monsters and then, you know, finding 5e things that were more or less equivalent and then tweaking them a little bit to match the special abilities. This is something that I see people say you can't do a lot, and I get what they mean, which is that 5e has a lot of fiddly bits, and this is actually not how any of those fiddly bits work. So technically, none of what I was doing made any sense from a 5e standpoint. But what I think a lot of those people are overlooking is, who cares? That doesn't matter. It's actually totally okay to just make up some nonsense, and that's what I did. And it worked out just great. Players hated it, by which I mean they had a good time, but they were very distressed by all the weird, creepy monsters and death traps and whatever. Okay, so that is about all the time we have for bonus content for today. Coming up this week, we've got a meta special episode. And now that I've worked out a new recording solution for My Favorite Monsters, we've actually got a few My Favorite Monsters coming up over the next weeks and months as well. So I hope that you will join me for those right here on Monster Man. A show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram @MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.